Morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are and what time of the day you're listening to Talking the Blues. As ever, I have Andy and George with me. Good afternoon, George.
Hi, guys.
And good afternoon, Andy.
Good afternoon, Paul. Hi there, kid. How are you doing?
All right, brother. All right. Good.
Well, I hear that despite all of the obvious and terrible events that are sort of befalling us and we're surrounded by, that the weather in the northwest, Andy, is absolutely glorious.
It is absolutely stunning today. It was a bit cool and a bit miserable yesterday, but today it is glorious. I've just been for my walk, and it was very, very pleasant indeed.
Okay. Who would we have played this weekend?
Oh, crikey. That's a good question. Hang on. I've got a fixture list behind me. April. We would have been at home against Southampton.
Ah, okay. On a Saturday?
Having won at Spurs last week, we would have been at home against Southampton.
And would that have been the Saturday, or would it be in this afternoon?
What's today, the 19th? In which case it was yesterday, the 18th, yeah. This is marvellous fantasy football. So I mean, did we beat Spurs by, Andy?
4-1.
Come on! Actually, I went! I knew that was going to happen. I got stopped on the motorway for travelling when we shouldn't.
Who scored?
Daricott got 3.
Daricott?
Terry Daricott got a hat trick.
Come on, Terry Daricott.
Is that the first time?
And a Christian Eriksen own goal.
No, a Dele Alli own goal. That'd be funnier.
Terry Daricott.
I know.
Anybody who's not old enough to know Terry Daricott, he's an absolute legend.
Absolutely. You need to get on YouTube and see some Terry Daricott.
Yeah. Well, actually, given that nobody can have their hair cut at the moment, a few of us are going to end up looking like Daricott.
They're all going to look like Terry Daricott.
There's every chance for that.
You think of the legends we've had at right back. Hibbert, for God's sake.
Tony Hibbert, yeah.
Yeah, man. Tommy Wright.
Are you a big
Seamus.
Yeah. We had a right back who only played one game at right back.
Oh, is it
Cuco Martina?
Oh my God.
Cuco Martina. He had one game, which was, I think, was the pre-season friendly against who was it? Was it Valencia? No, not Valencia. Yeah, it might have been Valencia. I can't remember who it was now. And he played at right back, and then every other game he played in the Premier League was in left back.
I saw him play left back at Newcastle. I went up there to watch his win 1-0. Wayne scored, and he was obviously unbalanced because he's obviously clearly a right-footed player. He didn't have too well.
He did it
because I was really quite close to that touchline, and it was fascinating watching the man, deal with a physical problem of not being balanced properly. But he did really well.
He got a lot of stick, Martina. But I always felt he was one of those players who did his best. His best might have been woefully short of the level required, but I always felt that he gave his all for the club when he played. And it wasn't his fault he was played out of position. We had injuries, and he was the only person who could cover. And he did his level best, which, as I said, the level might not have been good enough, but you can't fault a guy for... I mean, he never shirked the challenge. That's the thing that got me. He never shied away from it. He always turned up and gave what he could.
Yep.
And that's all you can ask of a footballer, really.
You can ask of anybody.
Mm. Yeah.
And he has a very good reputation in the game as being, an honest pro.
Yeah. Yep.
So hardworking, trains well. Represents the clubs that he's played for very well. Never got into trouble. Never seems to have done anything inappropriate.
No.
So Yeah, he gets his, he needs an upgrade in his personal PR department.
Yeah, there's probably a few who played for Everton that could do with helping. I know Tony Hibbert was another one. He never gave less than his all, but boy, did he need some help in the PR department.
What was that, John?
I said he was a class act, Tony Hibbert. Got a lot of time for Tony Hibbert. There was when I can't remember who was got injured, and he had to come inside and play centre half, and it was, you know, one of those moments where you go, wow, look at that.
That was Benfica away when Seamus Coleman made his debut.
Yeah,
and I was there that night. We had a great day out in Benfica. Well, we had a great day out in Lisbon. Only the match
kicked off.
Yeah, and Hibbert had to play at centre half. It's like,
yeah,
five foot, you know. And I mean, I know we got walloped 5-0 on the night, but actually, he didn't disgrace himself. Some people don't look back at players and think, you know, actually, you know, where was he on the day when everything went pear-shaped for him? Well, he was totally out of position and a foot short in height. Is it any wonder we got thumped? You know, but hey-ho. Me and Holly are still having therapy for Lisbon because we went back to Sporting Lisbon a couple of months later. And we had another fantastic day walking around Lisbon and up the castle, and we found this fantastic little ice cream parlour down towards the docks. It was absolutely beautiful ice cream. And then we went to the match and got beat again. So Lisbon as a city has got good memories. Lisbon for a day out for football, no.
George, have you been to Lisbon?
I have, yeah, I've worked in Lisbon. So it was, Andy's right, beautiful place.
Yeah,
really lovely city.
Fantastic place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so listen, just one thing on actually, we could do many things on Tony Hibbert, but just one thing in particular. I've still not quite forgiven him for the 2009 FA Cup final.
Hibbo?
Yeah. When he just melted in the heat.
I think we were all melting in the heat that day, Paul, to be fair. Moyes should have realised earlier that he was getting taken apart down that flank. I mean, he didn't have to wait till half time. He should have been wise enough or smart enough to see what was going on and do something about it way earlier than he did. But yeah, I mean, Hibbo did get torn apart that day, and he was obviously suffering with the heat.
Yeah.
All right. What options did Moyes have at that moment? Can you remember?
Was it Alex Anderson? I think the option was Alex Anderson.
Right.
I mean, that right side of the pitch was getting, wasn't just Hibbo. I mean, Ozzy was in front of him, and Ozzy was struggling with the heat as well, and getting taken apart by, was it Malouda?
Yeah.
Good memory.
Yeah, Florent Malouda, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a shame. Again, it was a great day, then where the result went against us, and there you go.
So, substitutes for Everton. Who's the goalkeeper? Anyone remember?
The goalie substitute. Oh, my God. I remember Tim was in nets. Who was the sub? I don't know. Do you know?
I've just looked it up. I'm not going to pretend I know.
Who was it?
Carlo Nash.
Oh, right.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Saw him play.
I was just going to ask that. Did Carlo Nash actually? I'm struggling now. How many first team games did Carlo Nash have, Paul? Can you look that up? Because I can't.
He never played a senior.
No, I was just thinking. I can't. I don't ever recall seeing him.
That's good. I thought I might be hallucinating.
In fact, his last six clubs, he only played for one of the last six clubs that he was at. two loans in that. So if we take out the loans, so the last five clubs, He only played at Stoke City. He played 10 games in 2008. Right. So this is interesting, actually. So a professional footballer earning whatever professional footballer earned in those days, between 2007 and when he retired in 2014, he played a total of 10 games.
Wow. I suppose that's testament to the goalies he was backing up to.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Pardon?
Not necessarily.
Ah, you reckon they've all sussed out he was a sieve? Don't play the sieve, just put him on the bench in case of emergencies.
That's cruel. Andy.
That's cruel.
Okay, so we had Carlo Nash, and then let's go with the unused substitutes first.
Oh, crikey.
In that match?
In the 2009 FA Cup final, yeah.
Oh, you've obviously got the records in front of you, Paul, so put us out of our misery.
Segundo Castillo.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Who?
Segundo Castillo.
Was he Ecuadorian?
Yes.
Or Colombian?
Was he Colombian?
Ecuadorian. He was South American for sure. He scored in a Europa League game at Goodison and high-fived the referee. He had massive thighs.
Yeah.
He had thighs like genuine tree trunks. And he smote a volley at Goodison in the park end. And I can't remember who the opposition were, but he absolutely blistering goal. And he turned round to celebrate. And the first person he ran into was the referee and he high-fived him.
I saw him play a game at Stamford Bridge. And it was 0-0. And he performed fantastically. I think it was the best game that he... Yeah, I mean, he didn't have many for us, but it was the best game that he had for us. And he was fantastic on the day.
Right.
And that was when, Chelsea had a really good midfield. Mm. Anyway, so Segundo Castillo, Jack Rodwell on the bench.
Right. Jack Rodwell.
Played in the semi, though, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, played in the semi against United.
Having seen everybody ask everybody else if they'd watched Sunderland Till I Die, I actually watched it. Have both of you watched it?
I've watched the first series.
I haven't. Andy certainly has.
Okay. The first series included the bit about Jack Rodwell on transfer deadline day.
Yeah.
It was shocking, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely appalling.
Don't tell me. Don't spoil it, because I am going to watch that.
All right. It's well worth watching, bro.
No. Everybody says so.
Okay, and the other unused substitute was Jose Baxter.
Wow.
Oh, wow. What happened to him? Where did he go?
Oh, his career nosedived big time because he got involved in the old white powder, didn't he?
All right.
Yeah,
and what do we think is the reason why Rodwell's career died so badly?
He was too injury prone, wasn't he? It didn't matter where he was, he could never sustain a long stretch in the side. He was always having an injury. I did it with us and then at City, and it's a shame really, because he had bags of talent, that boy.
He was marked for a big international career at some point.
Yeah, he was future Everton captain, future England captain, the whole world.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say, because the lawyers have just phoned me to say that Jose Baxter was never prosecuted or even charged.
The lawyers have called to say what? Jose Baxter had nothing to do with anything.
No, he was arrested on suspicion of possession of cannabis.
Oh, is that right?
Attempt to supply and on suspicion of possessing counterfeit money.
Oh, my God.
Mickey Thomas syndrome.
Yeah, he was subsequently released without charge.
Right.
Just so that the lawyers are happy with that one.
Right, fair enough. Thank you, Paul. The Lord.
Good player, Jose Baxter.
I always liked the boy.
Yes, I saw him once. He was really good.
Yeah, he had a great pre-season game against Notts Forest. I remember he scored a belter at the City Ground.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Were you there? Did you go to a pre-season game?
I used to go to all sorts of silly games as a kid. I was a bit puddled in those days. But to be 100% truthful, I wasn't at the City Ground that day. I can't remember how I watched it now, but I saw it live.
The lawyers have been on. They said you're still puddled.
They're probably right. But while we're on that 2009 Cup final, Paul, who were the unused subs for Chelsea that day? Have you got that?
Yeah, I have. I'm a real stat over here, aren't I?
Yeah.
Hilario in goal.
Right.
The Portuguese. Ivanovic.
Right.
Belletti. Michael Mancini.
Right.
Franco Di Santo. And Kalou.
That bench sounds immeasurably stronger than our bench.
Yeah, well, they had one substitute, which was Michael Ballack.
Yeah.
We had Lars Jakobsen.
Lars Jakobsen, that was it, not Anderson. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, dear. And we scored too early that day, was the bottom line.
We did, didn't we?
Yeah.
There you go.
It was great, though.
Michael Ballack, good player.
Yeah.
Very good player.
Yeah.
He scored a corker at Goodison one day when they beat us 4-3 or something. When Jose was the manager. A beautiful volley. We scored three really good goals and those expletive deleted. We scored four.
Wasn't that at the Gladys Street end and it went in off the bar?
I think it was. That rings bells.
Yeah, and I mean, it beat Tim Howard all ends up and crashed in off the bar.
Mm. Yeah, that was the one.
Yeah, and sort of bounced down just into the back of the net.
I remember a great goal that Michael Essien scored at Goodison. Chelsea won 1-0.
This is a very strange section of talking the Blues.
No, no.
Great goals people scored against us.
I know, well, but it was an absolute screamer from Essien.
Listen, we had some sad news this week, didn't we? Not Everton related, but sad news in terms of football related, with the very sad passing of Hunter. So at Leeds United, because in the run up to the podcast, you guys were just mentioning, I didn't really see much of that Leeds team, but I guess you two both did.
Yeah,
you missed. Oh. This is tricky because, of course, it's sad, and I do believe in rest in peace. But my God, I hated him as much as I hated almost everybody in that team.
Mm.
And I thought about it, obviously, because it's not a good thing to think. When I heard that he died, and of course, you know, it's really simple. If he played for Everton, he would have been a hero. It's just tribalism in action, because we had players like him. Every team had players like him. But as you were saying, Andy, Leeds had, you know, quite a few in that time.
Yeah, there was. I mean, don't get us wrong. I mean, any Leeds fans that may be listening to us, they were a wonderful football team when they played football. But when they decided that it was win at all costs, they were absolutely agricultural in their approach to games. I mean, there was scything tackles were the order of the day, literally. And I mean, that was what brought about that famous incident at the baseball ground against Derby when Franny Lee had just about had enough and squared up to Norman Hunter and went for it big time. If I remember right, Franny Lee put him on his backside as well. But I mean, it is sad, you know, when players, you know, that we kind of grew up with, and whether we loved them or hated them. You know, you wouldn't have wished coronavirus on Norman Hunter, and you know, to pass away, you know, that way. But you're right, Arkid. Every back in those days, every side had a hard man, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, there was some real thugs about in the game. I mean, we all remember that Ron Harris at Chelsea, surely.
Well, Nobby Styles became a national hero.
Yeah, he did.
Based on the fact that, you know,
if you got past him and escaped with all your tendons intact, he must have dropped a contact lens or something. Peter Storey, who played for Arsenal, was vicious. And, you know, Everton had enforcers. Jimmy Gabriel took no prisoners. But that was the way the game was, and definitely all the better for it. When you watch some of those games now, and somebody plays the ball up to a forward who's standing with his back to the goal, and you go, oh, no, because you know what's coming.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to go straight through them at the ankles.
It's hard to, you know, I
must be fair to myself and say I did not love that Leeds team at all. And, yes, they could play some football, but Revy was anti-sport to me.
It would have been interesting to see how that Leeds team could play had, I mean, we all know what happened when Cloughy went there and only lasted 44 days. But had they been coached by someone who wanted them to play football and not play cynically, it would have been good to see just how good a football team
we are going to get
really
such stick from Leeds fans about this. Because they did, you know they did.
I know they did. No, don't get me wrong.
It's been all manner of people playing wonderful football.
Yeah, but when it was win at all costs and no matter what, I mean it was ugly at times.
Oh, darling, I hated Leeds United. I hated everything Revy stood for. I don't take it back to say that I thought it was anti-sport. And then, you know, when they went into that fawning, oh, we'll wave to the crowd and we'll throw them our socks and things, you just went, oh, go on, boil your heads.
I wonder if they got an ethical bonus for that. Throwing those little number tags out of their socks into the crowd. Did they get a bonus for that? We need somebody to go and investigate that one.
Nothing would surprise me about Revy and his pursuit of money.
Yeah. I'll do a twirl on the centre circle and wave to the crowd and then lob your sock numbers into the crowd. Oh, there's got to be a couple of quid in that, haven't there?
Tell us about ethical bonuses, Paul.
I will in a second. Just one. Talking about football hard net, I always remember, and I remember this from my childhood, my grandfather, who, as I've explained previously, you know, was a mad Evertonian. He said to me that the hardest player he ever saw play was the Hungarian Puskas.
Right.
And he told me a story, and I've never seen it in print, but he played in the 1954, and I remember this when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my grandfather telling me this. Hungary beat Brazil in the 1954 World Cup semi-final. And somehow Puskas ends up in the Brazilian dressing room after the game. And apparently a fight broke out and he took on the whole of the Brazil team. And I always remember my granddad saying he had a beer bottle in one hand and a football boot in the other.
Crikey.
And I've never seen a story printed anywhere. But I remember my grandfather telling me that story.
Revenge Puskas.
Yeah, 1973 or 74, something like that. He would have told me that story.
Wow.
Yeah, because he was, from what I know of him, he was a very graceful footballer, wasn't he?
Puskas, he was the absolute hub of that 55 team that destroyed England twice. And oh no, he was gorgeous, but he was chunky.
Yeah. Well, apparently, he could hand it out if he needed to.
Well, Puskas's lawyers are on the phone.
Yeah. It's true. So is the beer bottle company and boot company.
Yes, I'm going to say, you want the beer bottle?
How many did you hit with the boot?
There's always that. I mean, the football boot thing, it was Alex Ferguson, wasn't it, who kicked the boot in it and it hit David Beckham just above the eyebrow.
Yeah.
That would have been an interesting occasion.
You'd like to have been a fly on the wall for some of those, wouldn't you?
Well, for some
did you ever
things.
Hear that fantastic story about Ferguson was appointed manager of Scotland, or he said he'd do it for one game. They were out in Trinidad or somewhere. I'm going to get the details wrong, but somebody will correct me, but I love this story. And whoever it was, the Trinidad centre-half, just kicked the Scottish centre-forward, who was one of those little guys, all over the park for 45 minutes. And they came in for the interval. They came in for the interval, there's an actor talking. They came in at half-time, and Ferguson said, right, sit down, give me your shirt. And he went out there in the second half. And he went out there with the sole purpose of dealing with this centre-half. And he had one go at him and missed him. And the referee came over to Ferguson and said, I know what you're doing. If you do it, I'll send you off. And Ferguson said, fine. And then did him. Got this guy completely, totaled him. Guy's carried off. Ferguson takes the red card. Goes up. Well, he won the red card in those days. Goes off. And then in the dressing room after the match, he said to the players, this story ever gets out, you're all toast. And obviously it did, but those were the days when, you know.
So now we've got Ferguson's lawyers on the phone as well.
Yeah, no, going, that's absolutely right. Come on, market it.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy. Anyway, ethical bonuses.
Yeah, big one.
I am reliably told that Everton don't
have... Should we just explain to anybody who missed the one about Neymar what we understand them to be?
Yeah, Neymar gets paid, I can't remember the figure now, is it 375,000 euros a month for going and applauding the fans, PSG's fans at the end of a game. And it's referred to in his contract as an ethical bonus. And not only Neymar, but all of the PSG players gets a bonus, albeit not the same magnitude. I think from memory, we said that the smallest bonus was 30,000 euros a month.
And we were all applying for jobs as ethical bonuses. We wouldn't play the games, we wouldn't muddy the shirts, we'd just go on and clap the fans at the end.
Well, frankly, it's not worth getting out of bed for that amount of money, is it?
No. So anyway, go on, Paul. I remember asking you, does that go on in England?
So you asked me to see if I could find out whether it goes on in England, and I asked a couple of people who will remain anonymous. But, it certainly doesn't happen at Everton. We don't have ethical bonuses in our contracts. And that's probably accurate because I think... what was the away game earlier this season where only Sidibe came over and applauded?
Oh, yeah.
Was that Watford?
I think it was Watford. No, we won at Watford.
Oh.
We won at Watford.
Anyway, we don't have ethical bonuses at Everton, you'd be glad to hear. But I was told by one of the two parties that I spoke to that there is at least one club in the Premier League that has, it's not called ethical bonuses, but has a similar arrangement. But unfortunately, he wouldn't tell me who.
Fair play. Which leads us on to extraordinary, you know, what is going to happen to football and the finances by which we have known it growing to the point where we left football. Wages, costs, so on and so forth, and the after effects of coronavirus, when I think I read this week that the Italians are not expecting to play in front of crowds this calendar year. Is that right?
I believe they're not expecting to play in front of crowds until at least March of next year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... there will be no ethical bonuses, one assumes, for clapping the empty seats. But, well, you know, the bigger point remains about what can we extrapolate out from this where football is financially going in the time before we all get to watch it again?
yeah, it's gruesome reading. Football just cannot continue to pay the level of wages that it pays if, as some of the world's major economists and forecasters forecast, that the as a result of the coronavirus, the world's economy goes into a major recession or perhaps a depression. I've written on a couple of occasions now that football is entirely supported by discretionary spending, and discretionary spending by individuals and companies.
Like me buying a Sky subscription.
Yeah, you don't. It might affect your quality of life in not having it, but it's not essential for you to have it.
No.
And there's nothing at all associated with football that is essential to anybody other than anybody that's involved in football.
Correct.
Yeah. As much as we all love it, and as much as thousands of podcasts like ours are broadcast on a daily basis and people listen to them, I mean, it's a fundamental part of our being and of modern life, football. But when it comes to the choice between putting food on the table, clothing your children, even having a roof over your head, it suddenly ceases to be important. If you're having to make those types of sort of economic choices because either you're unemployed as a result of the recession or because your income has dropped dramatically, football, along many other things, is just going to, the income will just dry up.
So if that, personally, I must pin my colours to the mast here and say, if that's what's going to happen, I'm not going to shed any tears for people not being overpaid king's ransoms to do something they enjoy doing. I'm a very lucky person. I love doing my job, but basically the most I've ever been paid is 500 quid a week to do it. So the idea that I go and watch, Tony Ibbett, oh no, that's unfair, Neymar, get 10 times my annual salary just for clapping and mind playing, I won't shed any tears over that. But how do you see a club like Everton being in 12 months' time, if what you're saying is true, Paul? How will it work? Will we turn up to the match and find that the tickets have now gone down to a fiver?
Well, no, because that won't help the club.
All right.
Everton's a slightly unusual one in the sense that gate money is a relatively low element of our overall revenues. How does it affect Everton? Well, frankly, if the worst happened in terms of the amount of revenues that football clubs get, and from that I mean broadcasting revenues fall substantially, then effectively almost every club becomes insolvent. Technically insolvent. That's ultimately what happens. When I say technically insolvent, I mean the directors would have to recognise with the current cost structure against the current income structure, the business can't survive. Now, legislation has changed in the last few weeks as a result of the coronavirus, in that you can continue to run a business even when you think or you have knowledge of it being technically insolvent. Prior to that, it was a criminal offence to do that. So the response always when income falls in a business has to be, you either find new customers or you cut your costs dramatically. Football can't really find new customers because in this scenario we're talking about, the paying demand isn't there because people can't pay for the product. So they have to cut the costs. And the biggest cost is player wages. And I'm not saying this from the perspective of oh, they're extraordinarily wealthy, therefore they should take a cut. I don't subscribe to that at all. They're extraordinarily wealthy because somebody offered them the contract that they signed, not because, if not for any other reason. I just think that ultimately football can't survive paying the level of wages that it pays. And footballers and their agents will have to realise that, and they'll have to come to terms with that. And there will be a significant reduction in how much players are paid.
And do you think that would be enforced, Paul, by a wage cap rather than players and agents agreeing to it with a gentleman's handshake? Do you think that the authorities are going to have to enforce it with a Premier League wage cap, Championship level wage cap, League 2, League 3, whatever?
I think it's very difficult in the Premier League. I saw some stuff about the English Football League, I think on Friday, where they were suggesting a wage cap of £6,000. Now, a wage cap of £6,000 would probably apply to almost every championship player. But it wouldn't apply to many in Division 1, and it would apply to hardly any in Division 2. So that wouldn't help the smallest clubs.
Right.
If you have a wage cap that's much higher than the wages that you currently pay, you don't have a wage cap.
No. But in the Premier League, could a wage cap? I mean, I suppose you look at the differences between the very top club, what the top clubs pay, and what the clubs down the bottom end of the table pay. I mean, you know, could. Where would you pitch the figure, and how would that impact? Because if it was, let's just say for argument's sake, £30,000 a week, you know, yeah, you've got players at the likes of Liverpool, United, probably Everton, Chelsea, Arsenal, who are going to think, sod that for a game of soldiers. Whereas this players at, you know, maybe Bournemouth.
Where are they going to go?
Well, I don't know. That's the thing. I mean, there aren't going to be the jobs, because every league all over the world is going to contract as a result of this, surely, because unfortunately, sadly, there's going to be an awful lot of clubs in the lower levels will go to the wall. So there won't be the jobs there, so they'll have to accept it. It's just, where would the authorities pitch a wage cap?
Can I just, before you attempt to answer that, Paul, sorry, Andy, can I just ask, because I don't know, who are the authorities you're talking about? Who has the power to enforce that on clubs?
I guess the Premier League and the FA.
Right, okay.
But for the Premier League, we talk about the Premier League as being an authority. It is an authority, but it's a self-managed authority.
Right.
It's
managed by the clubs.
It's managed and owned by the clubs. So anything that the Premier League decides is actually decided by the clubs, not by the Premier League. If you get my drift,
right? Yeah, right.
So, I think the rule is that there's always 20 members of the Premier League, obviously, and to pass anything at within the Premier League, 14 clubs have to agree.
That's what just happened in Scotland, isn't it?
Yeah. Scotland's got the same structure. It's slightly different, but the same structure in terms of, you know, you need a significant
numbers.
Majority of clubs to agree to something before something can happen. So whatever scenario the Premier League paint, it would have to be agreed by at least 14 clubs.
Well, then do we expect 20 football clubs to sit down and go, right, guys, we're not playing football, you know, we're not, there isn't money to be made from games played behind closed doors. How, do you think they're going to be sensible enough to sit down and go and talk about something like a wage cap?
I don't think so, because I think when you look at the top six clubs, what they pay in wages, certainly the top five, compared to the rest. They've got such a competitive advantage that they're not going to give that up. You know, United, $332 million in wages. This is just on a big spreadsheet, so I'm going to have to flick around a bit. Liverpool, $302 million on wages.
But they can't sustain those figures, Paul.
No. City on 280, Arsenal 234. Oh, sorry, City 316 million. 280 million is number 12. Who is? Hang on. This makes great listening. Chelsea. So they're miles ahead. We're the sixth biggest spenders on wages, Everton, and our wages are 160 million. So. And we can't continue to afford that. So it would have to be significantly below 160 million. Mm. There's no way that United City,
Are you telling me that as a business, you know, you're a businessman, that these six clubs are going to hang on to their power position and pay people a fair proportion of that wage to not play football rather than sit down and have a proper discussion about how the whole league survives? Is that what you think will happen?
What they're not going to do is say, let's pick a figure, 100 million. We're going to reduce our wage bill from 332 million, which is Manchester United's, to 100 million.
They won't do that?
They won't have that imposed upon them. Now, it may be that some point in the future they have to do that because that's the only way their business can survive. But I don't think anybody in that position would allow them it to be imposed upon them. They would have, I think it'll end up individual clubs negotiating with individual players, and they will reduce the size of the squad as much as they possibly can. So,
right.
You know, the under 23s will all but disappear. And the squad of 25 might become a squad of, say, 18. So if a squad of 25 becomes a squad of 18, you know, you've got like nearly a third saving there, assuming everybody gets paid the same, which obviously they won't. So like for Manchester United, that might mean like £100 million saving just by reducing the size of the squad. I think that's how they'll do it to begin with. And then the people that are left, they'll go to individual players and say, you're getting £150,000 a week. We can only afford to pay you £80,000 a week, for example.
Right.
And it will have to work on that basis. And what they might do is they may say, if the situation returns to normal in 2 years' time, you can go back to what you were on then. What you're on now, but because the situation is what it is now, this is what you have to do.
But even that's impossible, because in 2 years' time, some of these players, some will be, you know, not worth that kind of money because of just the simple aging process that happens in this business.
Yeah.
It just sounds like the blind not seeing what the situation is.
But I can't believe that the conversation that we're having now isn't being had in 20 Premier League boards.
Surely to God, it must be. Yeah. You would imagine the plain simple fact of the matter is everybody's got to reduce the cost. And as Paul said, the biggest cost in all the clubs at the moment is player salaries. So you would imagine that, or you would hope that the hierarchy within each club is sitting down either en masse or probably individually with the players and or their agents and saying, listen, fella, you know, we can't afford it. We simply can't do this because the business is going to go pear-shaped. You know, we might not have football here in
X number of months' time. We don't know when we're going to be playing. All those variables that nobody knows anything about. So we've got to ask you to agree to a new contract at a vastly reduced rate, you know, until such time, you know. And the players, really, you would hope
sure
that they're sensible enough that they would, you know, they might not like it, but they're going to have to accept it.
But, oh, yeah, except why would it be done individually? Surely you have to go, look, we're all in the same game. We're all in the same boat. Bournemouth are more precarious than Manchester United simply because of finance. But we're all in the same game. We won't play each other unless we come up with some sort of plan to deal with this financial disaster that's coming at. Right, why are we not going, right, let's all agree to cut all expenses by this amount of money? Why would you go, come into my office, my boy, and let me see if I can talk you into this? I don't get it.
I'm only suggesting perhaps individually because of the disparity in wages within the individual squads. I mean, you know, we don't know for definite what players are on. You know, we only hear the paper talk, the rumour talk that such and such a player is on X number of £1,000 a week. We don't know absolutely categorically what they're on, but if you're saying, right, guys, everyone's got to take a 50% cut,
yeah,
you know, then the player that's on 15 grand a week is going to go down to 7.5 grand a week. The guy that's on 150 grand a week is going down to 75. Now, those disparities are there anyway, but the guy that's the guy that's at the bottom of the pecking order is suddenly thinking, hang on a minute. You know, I know we're all taking a 50% cut, but it's a damn sight more serious for me than it is for him. And that's why I think they probably have to do it individually. I don't know. I mean, it comes down to the, you know, the thing about, you know, should anybody know what anybody else earns? And apparently in football, we all know what everybody earns. You know, I mean, I've always worked on the principle that what I earn is between me and my governor and nobody else. You know, when you come out of the, you know, I used to negotiate a pay rise every year and whatever. That I would come out, I would go in, have the discussion, whether it was a formal appraisal and salary review on that, or whether it was just a general chin wag and we'd shake hands on a change in salary. But you come out and someone says, what did you get? And my answer was, not to do with you what I've got. Now, apparently in football, everybody knows what everybody else is on.
No, no, I was only going to say, because they talk to each other.
Yeah.
And they all talk to the press, and they've all got people sniffing around all the time for that information. I mean, I live in a completely cherished world where most of the theatre companies I work for, and I expect it to be like this, and if it was down to me, it would be like this. Everybody gets paid the same.
Mm. But that doesn't happen in football, does it?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, even in the work I used to do, you know, if I had guys who were all on different money, well, there was a company I worked for where all the staff I inherited, I had 14 staff work under me, and the first thing I did was look at all the, and they were all on different money, and it was all up and down like a bride's nighty, and it was like, hang on a minute, it took me 3 years, you know, through appraisals and what have you, to get guys who were all doing the same job on as close to the same money, because I just didn't see that it was, I didn't think it was right that Joe got 25 quid a week more than Fred for doing exactly the same job. You know, there might be a little bit disparity depending on their individual capabilities and skills, but basically they were doing the same job. But apparently not in football. Somebody's on 10 grand a week and happy as Larry, and somebody else demands 150 grand a week and gets it for doing the same job. Oh, that's killed it.
Mm-hmm. I was shaking my head. That kind of emoji that you sent, yeah. God, don't believe what I'm talking about, really. I mean, it feels like, come on, wake up, smell the coffee, do something. But, you know, I suppose they've all got huge wage bills and huge buildings and things, you know, stadium to keep up, and I don't know. Mm. I can't see the logic of it myself. I would rather football took the lead and went, this is what we're going to do.
George, one of the interesting things about footballers is they're not employed like everybody else is.
No.
They're given fixed-term contracts. So you will play for us for the next 4 years, and this is what you're going to receive, you know, whatever the figures are. A footballer, unlike almost anybody else, can't leave their employment without the permission of their employer. And they can't even talk to another employer without the permission of their current employer, if you use the word employer, because they're not really employed by them. So they're in a... This is not how I feel sorry for a footballer. They're in a slightly difficult and different position from most people. And this is why I think it has to be done on an individual by individual basis. So you can... A club might say, our objective here is to reduce wages by 50%. Therefore, we'd like everybody to take a 50% pay cut. But they would have to do that on an individual by individual basis. You can't impose, you know, a new condition on a contract unless both parties agree to it.
Yeah, it's got to be negotiated, hasn't it?
Yeah. You know, I've got a contract with you to supply you with certain goods and materials, services, whatever, and you've agreed to pay me £1 million for it. Well, if you ring me up having received the goods and the services and say, actually, I've decided because times are tough, I'm only going to pay you £500,000, what do I end up doing? I end up suing you for breach of contract. And that's exactly what would happen in a football situation, if a salary deduction or a wage deduction was imposed upon a player.
Right. So then we get to a situation that apparently Arsenal have negotiated with their players. Correct me if I'm wrong, Paul. Where Arsenal players have agreed for a reduction in their wages, pending qualification for the Champions League.
Yeah.
So that's their incentive then. Not to throw the toys out of the pram at having lost a few quid, but to go when they're back on the field to go out and perform, get Champions League, and then get back to the silly money.
Yeah, and because the assumption is that Arsenal will generate more money by being in the Champions League.
Yeah. They can afford to repay it.
That, you know, they've got more money to pay their players. Yeah, and that makes sense. Makes sense if you believe getting back into the Champions League is going to pay you more, because the same issues that the Premier League have, the Champions League have, in terms of, you know, a TV company's ability to pay the rights that they're currently paying. And, you know, everybody says, oh, well, these companies are massive. You know, Sky is a massive company. It is a massive company, obviously. But ultimately, the money that Sky pays to show the Premier League is derived only from two sources. It's derived from the monthly subscription that we pay. So, mm-hmm. You know, the direct debit that goes out of the bank every month. And it's paid by advertisers.
Advertising revenue, yeah. Yeah.
And advertisers are only advertised because they want people to buy their product. And if people stop buying their product because we're in a global depression or a very serious, severe recession,
then their marketing budget goes out the window.
One of the first things a company does is reduce its marketing expenditure, because, yeah, if nobody's buying cars, it doesn't make any sense for Mercedes to spend an awful lot of money on promoting a car. I mean, they may want to still promote the brand so that there's brand awareness for the time when things get better. But they're not going to be out there promoting the brand new C-Class if nobody's buying cars. And I just want football to recognise that, and maybe they're working on it, you know, behind the scenes. But then I hear comments like, you know, business as usual, and I think, hang on a minute, either I'm wrong or you're wrong.
It's almost impossible to imagine things going back to business as usual. It's going to take far too long to get over this, this pandemic, and for economies globally to recover. I mean, it's not just the UK and Europe and football. It's everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't think of a country that's not been affected by it. So it's
Belarus, and Tajikistan. I think they're the only two countries that haven't had a.
Well, they're not admitted to it.
They're not admitted to it. But George, here's one for you. I think it's really interesting because it affects your business as well.
Completely.
Will people ever want to go back into a packed auditorium?
I can't answer that question, but if I believed it was safe and I believed that everybody had been tested and that the virus was gone, yes, of course, you'd be only human beings crave crowds. Human beings need to share things with other people. That's one of the things that makes us human beings. It's a pleasure, it's a pleasure to stand in, sit and stand in a big crowd and hear the same noise and feel the same emotion when, Tony Ibbett scores his only goal and all that kind of thing. Those things are fairly primal in us. Would I go to a theatre tomorrow? No. Would I expect anybody else to go? No. Just before we started the podcast, I was in conversation with one of my favourite directors who runs a really, really lovely theatre in Scotland, and he used a word I'm not going to use to say that for the moment theatre is finished. And what he meant was the whole essence of theatre is basically the same as professional football, is that we all gather in the same place to watch the same thing happen. And when it happens, in our case, when Everton win, the players are as joyful as we are. And that shared emotion is precious. And the same thing happens in a theatre. We all feel the story at the same time. And on a really good night, you all share the fact that the 400 people in front of you and the dozen of people on the stage have all felt the same thing. That's that's primal. But is it going to happen in the next 2 years? No. I don't think so. I think it will take a very long time for people's confidence to recover. Now, you can see the need for the crowd thing in those. I'll check out with their lawyers. Those American boneheads who are walking the street with flags and guns, going, "Give me my constitutional right to parade like an idiot in public." But what they're expressing is a need to be together in a way. And theatre is very like football in that sense. And the answer is no. I think it will, by the time, I think it will do exactly what football is doing. Football is obviously moving towards trying to play games behind closed doors. And I think theatre will do that. If you could assemble me 15 people who you proved have not got it and are not going to carry it and are not going to get it, then we could put a play on and we can film it and show it to you.
Right. I was going to say this because, I know it's drifting slightly away from football, but this could be a resurgence for the cinema, couldn't it?
Well, it's certainly a resurgence for armchair viewing, Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's what I meant. I meant on the screen, but not necessarily in a movie theatre, but certainly on the screen in your living room.
Yeah,
So, George, just follow that through for a second, because I think it does relate to football. You put on a play in 6 months' time because everybody's being tested. in an empty theatre that's filmed or streamed and people watch it, you know, wherever they may be.
Yeah.
Will that be the same product?
No. No, but it'll be, you know, if you really want to go to this, you know, this guy that I just wrote to, Dominic, who runs the Citizens Theatre, I said to him, look, you are one of the best dressers up of plays that I've ever worked with. And I'm not bad at my job, which is to three-dimensionalize something that's on a piece of paper and make it stand up so you go, oh, I kind of recognize that person. But we're just patsies. We're just servants of writers. That's all we do. Without a script, we can't do anything. If it's not a good script, you can dress it up any way you like, but it won't solve the problem. It's exactly like football. If you haven't got the players on the pitch and the cohesion that somebody brings to it, like a really good manager, then, you know, the product is underpowered. Now, the writers are not going to go away. In fact, they've got more to write about than anything than they've had for ages. And, you know, I'm sure their imaginations are going mad. So you can... You know, you can capture it. It's not the same thing as sharing it. But, you know, the National Theatre and a few other theatres have been streaming theatre live in cinemas. And whilst that's obviously going to stop for the moment, it's been very successful.
Mm-hmm.
So the medium will adapt and football will adapt. It will just hopefully get a whole lot cheaper for the paying public and a whole lot less gross in watching it, gross in the sense that I don't like the idea of how much certain players get paid or profit that's made. You know, every time I see the price of an Everton shirt, I go, oh, that's just cringeworthy, man. And I know where you've shipped it out to be built, to be sewed together in some sweatshop somewhere. You know what I mean? If those kind of things could come out of the game, I'd be in, like you said before, Paul, you know, I would love football to take a lead here. You know, there are clever people in football. If they'd stop thinking about their pockets and go, right, let us address this and let's find an equitable solution whereby we can, you know, answer the need that people have to watch football, because we do have a need to watch football. It's great.
One of the things that really interests me, and running short of time like we always do, is whether football without crowds is going to be the same product as football with crowds, because football has sold itself for a number of years very successfully on the whole experience thing.
Yeah.
You know, pre-match rituals, match, post-match rituals,
mm-hmm.
and obviously the match itself, the football is important, but it's seeing everybody.
Yes.
With no empty seats, you know. That's sort of one of the big drivers about the capacity of Bramley Moor, if it was to be built, is, you know, making sure that every seat is filled. And to go from that, which is how many, many people view football now, to playing in an empty stadium where you can hear the players shouting to each other, you can hear the ball bouncing off the pitch and stuff. It's going to be really interesting to see how they deal with that.
The person to ask that question to is a football player, because you and I can't answer it. But if Seamus Coleman said, no, if we're playing Liverpool, we're playing Liverpool. I don't care how many people. You know, a number of footballers have said to me, I don't hear the crowd. You don't hear the crowd. You just want to play, man. Now, you know, but if the experience was intense, which is what you kind of, then I think it. You know, we're certainly going to find out, aren't we? That's what the next stage is going to be, football behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And the proof of the pudding will be in the figures. You know, if we all watch it and go, oh, blimey, that's a bit yawny, isn't it? Or we all come away going, wow. See, I watched a YouTube match today between England and West Germany that I'd never seen. England won 3-0. And it was played in an empty stadium. It was in some tournament somewhere, and nobody in that country gave a toss about England and West Germany. But the match itself was, you know, played at a proper level and was intense and really good. But there was nobody, you know, almost nobody in the crowd. Mm. When England scored, they went to a little clump of people behind a Southampton FC flag.
But then I guess maybe a good producer then starts doing things like, you know, having much tighter camera angles and stuff.
That would be interesting to wonder how television would deal with it. Yeah.
Well, you just stop putting the camera on the stands.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, and
at the end of the day, if you're watching sport on the telly, you're watching the game. You're not looking at the saddle to say, oh, it's empty there. Oh, can that great big hole in the, I don't watch footy or any sport on the telly to say, oh, there's gaps in that crowd. I mean, you notice it, but it's not important. What you've turned on for is to watch the game.
That's true, but it would be interesting to see what players think about that.
Mm.
I'm the one with the limited experience here. If 25 past seven, we go, how many's in? And they go, it's packed. You go, come on. If they go, there's about 100 in. You go, all right. Oh, well, I'll go and do my job as best I possibly can. And sometimes you have an amazing experience, but you aren't half lifted by the presence of a whole pile of people who've come out to watch
you. I'm sure. And when the teams emerge from the dressing room before the game, and everyone's going loopy, and there's sirens going, and that, I take the point there that when they come out and there's nothing, and that's, I think we said this a couple of weeks ago, maybe they'll go for, I don't know, maybe they'll think of a piped atmosphere.
That would be horrible.
I know it would, but
canned applause.
You never know, do you? We don't know what's going on in the back. We don't know what's being negotiated or discussed, do we, really?
No, we don't.
I mean, it's like at the moment, I mean, the people at Run EasyJet announced the other day that when they get back to flying, they're going to have, there's no two people are going to be sat next to each other. It's going to be person, space, person, space, person, space. Well, can you do that in a football stadium? You got 40,000 seats at Goodison. What they're going to do? Allow 20,000 in one week and 20,000 the next week? How would that work?
These are all problems they have to deal with, but they've got bigger ones before they get to that, Andy.
Yeah, I know.
Andy, on the canned or the piped-in atmosphere.
Yeah.
The basketball league started Friday in Taiwan, and obviously the stadium is empty. There's nobody there because they have the same sort of distance, social distancing regulations as we do.
Mm-hmm.
So they put cardboard cutouts on every seat.
Hilarious.
And some clever soul.
An equal number of favours for each team.
I don't know about that bit. If I can,
we
if
had
I
no
can remember,
chance. Like, they had 40,000 cardboard cutouts. We only had six.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the joke is that Arsenal have been doing that for years.
On a serious note, if the basketball league in Taiwan has started again, I mean, that's a contact sport.
You can't start that unless all those players have been tested.
That's what I was going to ask. Have the Taiwan basketball authorities confirmed that every player has been tested and is currently clear?
I'm sure they have.
And I was thinking, if you wanted an example of where football should start its thinking about coronavirus, take a corner. Because in the penalty area, there's 18 guys all in each other's shirts, spitting, coughing, elbowing,
All we need to do is bring back zonal marking. And Marco Silva.
No, we're not. We're not going back to zonal marking, dear me.
gents, we're an hour and 10 minutes in, so
okay.
I think we better give our listeners some respite.
Come on.
As if life isn't hard enough for Evertonians at the moment, having to listen to us for over an hour.
Well, they don't have to, there's an off button.
No,
they do.
They do, George, because we have to pay our wages at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Of course we do, I've forgotten. And we're not dropping our wages.
And the solicitor's fees.
Ah, oh, dear. Eric, look, it's been fun, and it's gone all over the place, which is probably good.
It's good script.
Like Everton.
We said at the start that we had no script, and we've proven the case. So George and Andy, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
A great pleasure. Very, very funny. Whilst it's been fun, we obviously still are mindful of everybody out there who is suffering or has had a loss as a result of the terrible things that happened. So,
indeed,
you, anybody in that position, you're in our thoughts, and you're in the thoughts probably of every Evertonian and everybody else as well. But I think it's necessary to say, Dwi. So, God willing, we will be back next week, and we will continue our sort of unscripted conversation.
Look forward to it.
Yeah.
All the best, guys. Mate.
George, cheers. Thank you. Andy.
Cheers.